This Sunday, there will be a series of celebrations across the United States commemorating the freeing of the last group of slaves in American history. It's called Juneteenth, and this Sunday, you can take part in the party at the Pine Pavilion at Carson Park right here in the city of Eau Claire. To help us learn about more about the history of Juneteenth, the celebration itself, and where we're at with race relations in our region, in the state, and in the nation as a whole, we brought on a great panel of guests this hour. This is The West Side. I'd like to introduce my guests, and in no particular order. First, I'll start with Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton. She is a professor of history at UW-Eau Claire. Welcome to the program, Salika.
Thank you.
Good to have you on. Next is Chris Hambick-Boyle. She is president of the Eau Claire Area School District Board of Education. That is always a mouthful for me. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Burl Middleton is program supervisor with the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. He's also a former city council member. Comes to us today as a citizen of Eau Claire, I would imagine. Burl?
Yes.
Welcome
correct,
to the program.
Rich. Thank you very much.
And on the last but not least, we've got Jerry Stanisniewski. Is that
Staniszewski?
Staniszewski.
There you go.
Those Polish names always get me. And Jerry is, of course, Eau Claire's police chief. And I apologize for the mispronunciation. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-228-5615. Let us know what you think. If you're going to be taking place or taking part in the Juneteenth celebration, if you're not sure what it's all about, if you have a question about it or a comment, let us know, 1-800-228-5615. So first, let me start with Salika. And what is Juneteenth for people that might not know?
Well, while most people know that the Civil War ended in April of 1865, intransigent slave owners in western Louisiana and across Texas refused to tell their slaves that they were free. So their slaves were not freed until Union soldiers came into the area. June 19th is the date where the last plantation was liberated by General Granger on the orders of General Grant. So the Granger order, which we will read at the Juneteenth celebration, is what was read to each of these plantations so that the people knew they were now free.
Would it be a spoiler if I read it?
No.
Right here? Okay. So the Major General Gordon Granger went to Texas, relayed this General Order Number 3. Quote, "The people of Texas are informed that in accordance with a proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and free laborer."
This now enforces the Second Emancipation Proclamation. So Lincoln's last big act in office before he was assassinated was to proclaim that Emancipation Proclamation, freeing slaves throughout the entire United States.
Yeah, and it's just wild to me that I guess while the war was still ongoing, there was definitely no reason why a Confederate state that really wanted to hold on to that would listen to the Union.
What would happen is that because of the First and Second Emancipation Proclamation, wherever Union soldiers showed up, slaves ran away. You had no cotton. You have no cotton, you have no money. No money, you can't buy ammunition from the British. You can't buy uniforms. You can't buy rifles. In many ways, we starved the Confederacy for material as well as beat them on the battlefield.
Now, when students of yours, Salika, first find out about this, the fact that it was such a slow and delayed process for the emancipation, like in Texas, for example, what kind of reactions do they have?
Well, the first thing they ask me, and understand our students are very highly internet connected, is how could they not know? And I have to explain that you had telegrams as a fast mode of communication and horses. So if you didn't have access to one or the other, you wouldn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually have a couple of battles that are fought after the surrender because people just did not have communications technology.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm joined by guests including Jerry Staniszewski. He's Eau Claire Police Chief, Eau Claire's Police Chief. Burl Middleton joins us. He's with the Wisconsin Department of Corrections, also a former city council member here in Eau Claire. Chris Hambick-Boyle is president of the Eau Claire Area School District Board of Education. And Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, who you just heard, is a professor of history at UW-Eau Claire. 800-228-5615. We've got open phone lines for you if you've got questions or comments about Juneteenth or the celebration that's going to be happening this Sunday in Carson Park. So, I want to know more about the, you know, there's historical significance, of course, to this. This happened more than 150 years ago. But what does it mean to African Americans today? And Burl Middleton, I'd like to go to you now.
Well, as Salika has pointed out, you know, the historical aspects of how Juneteenth actually came to be, it's actually a portmanteau of June and 19th. Mm-hmm. So June 19th has some historical significance as well as some other significances. Primarily, what it has come to today, Rich, is not necessarily about black or white or race. It's about achievement.
Mm-hmm.
It is strictly about achievement. The Proclamation, Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 primarily freed slaves, but gave them also an opportunity. And at that time, the Union also began to recruit former slaves and freemen.
Sure.
So there was the achievement. It began actually on that very first day of the Emancipation Proclamation. So we see that today. And this year will be our 16th year for us to celebrate, to recognize, and to acknowledge Juneteenth. 41 other states, by the way, also observe Juneteenth Day.
Okay, so it's a state holiday, an official state holiday?
For some states.
For some states, okay. So what's going to be happening this Sunday? Salika.
I'll go back and forth with Burl because Burl is our chairman of the board at Uniting Bridges, which runs Juneteenth and the Martin Luther King program.
Okay.
So we will start at 2 p.m. at Pine Pavilion. We have a couple of proclamations that are going to show up from the city and from the county.
Mm-hmm.
We will have General Granger's letter, which will be read by our cadet commander here, who's incoming at UWC. So this will be his introduction to the community. And he'll be in his Army uniform representing the U.S. Army. We have State Representative Dana Watts will be giving us our welcome. And Charles Vu, who is an Eau Claire Area School Board member as well as the Associate Director of the Office of Multicultural Affairs mm-hmm. at University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, will be talking about challenges and opportunities for our youth towards excellence with an emphasis on multicultural youth and bridging racial gaps. So we see his speech as bridging last year where we talked about community engagement, and we still are very interested in community engagement with the police.
Mm-hmm.
We feel that the more the community works with the police and the more the police knows our multicultural community, the safer our multicultural community and the safer the police will be
sure.
in terms of exchanging information and being able to go after the real sources of problems. Then we will be feeding people free food,
right.
free food and drink. We'll have community sharing. And at this point, we have a DJ, so we will be spinning tunes, and hopefully, if it's good weather, people will be dancing.
That's excellent. 800-228-5615, if you've got a question or comment about the Juneteenth celebration here in Eau Claire, or about the history of it. I'm Rich Kramer, and this is The West Side. Let's take our first break real quick, and when we come back, we'll chat more about the event this weekend, and about many issues facing the nation, I guess, when it comes to race relations. 800-228-5615. This is The West Side.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Sheboygan Tourism. Sailing, paddleboarding, and charter fishing, all found on the shores of Lake Michigan. How do you Sheboygan? Information at visitsheboygan.com.
WPR's Big Top Overnight Trip leaves August 4th from La Crosse, Eau Claire, and Rice Lake. The motor coach brings us to the Big Top Chautauqua, where we'll see a performance of Steerage Song, and then the next day we enjoy Bayfield. Details at WPR.org/Western.
You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning. We're talking about Juneteenth. June 19th, there's going to be a celebration at Carson Park here in Eau Claire. It's going to be a celebration of Juneteenth, which is 150 years ago, the commemoration of the freeing of the slaves in the state of Texas, long after the Emancipation Proclamation was given and even after the war had come to an end. If you've got a question or a comment, let us know, 800-228-5615. I've got a great panel of guests, including Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton. She is professor of history at UW-Eau Claire. Chris Hambick-Boyle is president of the Eau Claire Area School District Board of Education. Burl Middleton is a program supervisor with Wisconsin Department of Corrections. He's also chairman of the Board of Directors with Building Bridges. And Jerry Staniszewski is Eau Claire's police chief. 1-800-228-5615. So achievement is what this is all about, and I like that message. Oh, I'm getting signals in the studio here. It's all about achievement. So part of achievement, I would imagine, has to do with education. So Chris Hambick-Boyle, tell us about the education's role in Juneteenth and some of the awareness that is raised through the event.
Well, I think any time that we can have conversations within our community and gather people together to have conversations relative to who we are as a community, not separate factions within our community, is a wonderful thing to do. As a public school, we've had to look in the mirror very, very deeply because Wisconsin has the largest achievement gap for black students in the nation. Our African American students do not do as well from the data as our white Caucasian students. And when we look at that achievement gap, it refers to the difference between how well African American and white students perform on a national benchmark test. It's the likelihood that our African-American students will be suspended from school, and it's also the difference between black and white students' graduation rates. So we're very, very aware of that. And I want our community to know that they can go into Board Docs on our website. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning of every year, in October, we do what we call an annual opening of schools and equity report. And that information is transparently there for everybody to look at. And I have a copy of it with me this morning, and I don't want to get into the specifics of it, but I want our community to know that as a district, we have looked very closely at the gap, mm-hmm. and we continue to do that with our community as well. And I can talk a little bit more about what we've done if you'd like me to.
Sure. I wanted to say we looked at some of that data from the district, and with regard to suspensions in 2014-2015 school year, the suspension rate for black or African American students was higher than any others, and so any idea what's playing into that?
Well, in our district, I think when you look at the statistics in our district, we have about 290 African American students mm-hmm. pre-K 12.
Sure.
So that's a pretty small percentage if you look at 11,200 some children that we serve and families we serve. We serve about 7,500 families, 11,000.
So as a percentage of the population.
Right. But I don't want to minimize it, though, mm-hmm. because it is important for us to provide what's needed for all kids, especially in public schools. That's what our job is to do. So we've had some higher numbers, too, in Eau Claire with African-American boys being referred for special education.
Mm.
And we looked at that very closely back in 2008. The federal government looks because we have to provide all that information. And so as a district, we decided to look into what that would look like to train our staff, deep professional development related to diversity. So we hooked up with Glenn Singleton and the Pacific Education Group, and we trained hundreds of our staff, not just on the diversity beyond diversity training through studying the Courageous Conversations About Race. This is, was an amazing journey for me. It really was. And we also then, the people who were trained in the Courageous Conversations and the Beyond Diversity, the next step was culturally relevant teaching.
Sure.
So we've really done the training and now embedded it into our behavioral, positive behavioral interventions and supports, where that is now embedded in our school buildings.
I think it's interesting. For a community that has, for a percentage of population, blacks and African American people, is pretty low. I think it's like 1% of the population of the city of Eau Claire. So I imagine it's when these issues start to become addressed, was there any pushback at all, or did people at the school district feel like, well, we don't have a problem with this? Because it's a situation where a lot of people, until they see the data, they don't realize it.
Well, I'll tell my own story.
Okay.
I always thought I was pretty accepting of pretty much everything.
Sure.
Until you really need to look in the mirror as to your own white privilege and what you've never experienced. And for me, that was, you can tell, it was life-changing for me.
Mm-hmm. Salika, any thoughts on this?
Well, I have a 16-year-old boy in the school district, so I've gotten to live through this process rather interestingly. I teach unconscious bias at the university. As Chief Staniszewski knows, I will work with the cadets at the Tech through Judy, usually once a semester if we get an opportunity. And people are affected by the stereotypes that they see in the media in real life. And sometimes what that means is you'll get differential punishment rates. In 2007, ironically, and I remember it very clearly because I had my daughter that year, across the school district, almost every African-American boy, including my son, was referred for special education.
Hmm.
Now, if you're a parent who doesn't have a PhD like I did, you don't know how to deal with the system. I went into an IEP meeting with an education person, and at the end of that meeting, not only was he not referred for special education, they found out he was gifted in two areas because they were actually forced to actually look at his test scores instead of the teacher's perceptions. That's why you had to train the teachers, because when teachers are stereotyping, it's unconscious. We all have unconscious biases. I'm black. I have unconscious biases. Mm-hmm. They come from the media. They come from marketing. And they come from the culture we're in. So to question those unconscious biases before we impose them on a student, and that includes me, when I'm in a classroom with white students, I have to question unconscious biases as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had those experiences where I've had to stop and say, you're stereotyping. So to do that in the classroom is very powerful, and I think that will help to bring down these disciplinary issues. There's also a term that's called complementary osmosis, which is where when we're upset or when we're stressed, it leaks onto our facial muscles, it leaks into our tone of voice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you can go into Thanksgiving and say, I'm not going to let Uncle Bubba push my buttons. And you come out of Thanksgiving, and not only has Uncle Bubba pushed your buttons, but you have gone over the roof.
Sure.
It's an unconscious reaction to people's facial expressions and tone. And the more unconscious bias training we get, the easier it is for people to react to this. So for police officers, unconscious bias training helps them, especially in dealing with mentally ill people, to de-escalate situations. For teachers, unconscious bias training helps them to de-escalate issues with students who, to be honest, if you have a 16-year-old, you know this, do not have their full frontal lobe development at this moment.
Right. With unconscious, you know, bias, I think also the fact that so many people don't have experience with communities that have people of color living in them. So these biases are they more informed by stereotypes that they might see on TV or something like that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Stereotypes that are in the media. stereotypes that are passed as cultural,
sure.
stereotypes that are reinforced by music videos, especially. Rap has not been a happy experience for my culture, especially after 1993, where gangster rap really was introduced with a set of stereotypes that date back to slavery, were engineered in slavery to try to get acceptance of slavery. So the more we recognize stereotypes, and not just black stereotypes, yeah. stereotypes of whites, mm-hmm. the easier it is for us to actually recognize what's going on and catch actual perpetrators.
Sure. 800-228-5615. Phone lines are wide open. We're talking about Juneteenth, what it is, the history of it, and also we're talking about the greater goals that celebrations like this that are focused on achievement and trying to get rid of achievement gaps is all about. So 800-228-5615. We've got a great panel of guests. Jerry Stanishevsky, excuse me. He's the police chief for the Eau Claire Police Department. Burl Middleton is a chairman of the board of directors with Building Bridges. He's also with the Department of Corrections. Chris Hammack Boyle is president of the Eau Claire Area School District Board of Education. And Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton is professor of history at UW-Eau Claire. My mouth is not working today. So with regards to education, do kids, say, in middle grade school, middle school, do they know what Juneteenth is, or what kind of things are they being taught in school now about, about slavery, about the Civil War, about civil rights?
Well,
Chris Hambick Boyle.
I just was a judge in the middle school history day, National History Day, and I don't know how I lucked out in getting both online presentations and single presentations and group. I had all of them. And I could tell as a board member, even though I spent my entire teaching career at the preschool level in special education, that there is an awareness there of our kids and a very intentional curriculum that is put forth by our educators. So I think actually I have to say this. I think our kids are much more aware than they were when I went to school, which I'm very
sure.
proud of.
And what would you attribute that to? Just the fact that everyone's got more awareness and there's more effort being put into it? Or do you think it's, beyond just the folks at the school?
Well, I really think that we've got some controversy going on in our country as well relative to public schools in general. The goodness of our public schools, do we offer the same in our public schools to all kids?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a deep conversation that's been ongoing. It's tied to funding of public schools and the fact that schools are funded the same or can offer the same. And then it gets deeply into the conversation about, I have a book that helped me understand a lot of this too. Both my parents were from Milwaukee and moved up, and I was born in Ashland. So what, one end of the state to the
right.
other. But I would go back to Milwaukee in the summers, and my uncle was with the Milwaukee police force, and my cousins all were on the force there as well. And Barbara J. Minor has written a book called Lessons from the Heartland, and it tells the history of education in Milwaukee. And I was little then, so I remember things, and I would stay with my uncle and whatever, but it was amazing what came back to me when I read this book. Relative to education in Milwaukee, and we're kind of still there. And so I'd like to make the point that people are talking more about it, learning more about public schools in Wisconsin and the equity that we need between our public schools to provide the best education for the kids we serve. And presently, the public schools serve the most kids. So.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Outside of, it's outside of our region, but Milwaukee, there's been a lot of news about Milwaukee public schools and the test results there and just the issues that district faces. But so you've seen one approach to trying to help people in that community. One approach is the voucher schools, which, is diverting public education money to private schools that in the hopes of, you know, getting better education to students, getting more choices to parents. I'm going to put you on the spot, Chris Hammack Boyle, and if anyone else wants to chime in on this. Is this a good solution as far as setting up almost a second public school system for the Milwaukee area, or do you think there should be a different approach?
Well, so goes Milwaukee. It goes the rest of the state is kind of how things have happened. And if I think about and look at the data for schools, private schools that receive vouchers, presently it's almost $8,000 for a child that goes to, in the statewide voucher, goes to high school, and about $74 now for an elementary grade school child. It doesn't seem to me, in looking at the data, that the voucher piece, that those schools do any better than the public schools. And that's proven. So to have two separate systems, and now that the voucher money for the private schools is coming from the public education budget, that impacts all of us. We're putting together frequently asked questions, because we are talking about a fall referendum, on what the impact of vouchers is to our budget. And so, and we're doing, actually, we're doing that in tandem with the non-publics in our community, so that before we go out with that frequently asked questions and the impact on our budget, we want them to know it as well and to vet it through our non-publics, because we've worked with our non-public schools for 40 years. We've been legislated to provide transportation for them. Mm-hmm. We've been legislated to provide special education and Title I services and other services, too, that comes from our budget. And we want to do that. We are the experts at that. We've been doing that for a very long time, and we continue to do that. So we're going to take those kinds of numbers and come up with a document that we will be sharing with our community. And we're doing that right along with our non-publics, because they are our partners, and we want them to remain our partners.
All right. With that, I want to move to, you know, from education to police and the relations between the police or law enforcement and the community. So what kind of links are there with students all the way down to, you know, kindergarten? Does teaching them more about issues of race or class or any of that make your job easier, cause less problems down the line? Jerry Staniszewski, excuse me.
Sure, I was waiting for the opening there.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you know, we talk about Juneteenth celebration, and that's a community event that I think is a good opportunity for us to make that face-to-face connection from law enforcement and community. So we don't look at it as a necessarily a separate, you know, incident that we have to be at. We just know it's part of the community. We're part of the community. And it's an opportunity to break down those barriers. We understand that there's fear when people look at the police department. And I think that's one thing that we focus on is making that real connection face-to-face, and that we're real people, everybody in the community, that we need to work together. It's not necessarily the community's responsibility to make sure we're safe. It's not necessarily the police department's responsibility. It's everybody, and we work together, you know, to make this one healthy and safe community together. And so I think that's the realization. Education is by far, I think, one of the most important aspects of a healthy community, and that awareness and the respect for each other, and valuing diversity. I think that's what makes us strong and important, and we reinforce that with the way we interact with the community.
You mentioned fear. Do you think that's a product of things that people might see or hear on the media, or is it a reaction to how, you know, officers act in the Chippewa Valley?
Well, I think fear of the unknown. I think surely the media portrays one aspect from a national perspective. I think we're pretty unique in Eau Claire in that we've developed a strong relationship with the community. I don't think there's necessarily a fear of Eau Claire police officers, but I think other people coming to the community don't understand our community values and the connection that we've made. So we have to continue to build those relationships, build that trust, that legitimacy of the police department. And so we can't just assume we're there and everything's fine. We have to continuously to build those relationships to make sure it doesn't go away.
So, of course, one of the forefront issues in the media across the nation over the past year and beyond has been in officer-involved shootings. According to research by the Washington Post, I mean, there are a bunch of different numbers by different news organizations, and there are studies that that you can look at. So the Washington Post, by their count, 986 people total killed by police in 2015, and every situation is unique, of course. About half of these people were younger African-American men. That gets a lot of attention, and it got an awful lot of attention, was the issue of police shootings of unarmed black men in very tense situations. So is this kind of thing, I would imagine, might contribute to that fear of police? And how has that complicated how you do your work in the community, Jerry Staniszewski?
Well, I think that communities that face those issues, the fallout, the negative fallout from officer-involved shootings, especially when involving race relations, I think that really is a deep-rooted observation of the trust they have in that police department for that community. Because usually the reaction is very quick, it's very swift right after the incident, before we know actually what happened or the details. But I think that the lack of trust maybe in the law enforcement department of that community is what heightens those problems. And so police departments have to take on the responsibility ahead of time to develop those relationships so that there is an opportunity to review the incident, talk about what happened, why it happened, so there's an understanding as opposed to assumptions. And that's where, you know, we run into trouble. So I think it's really a reflection of the amount of trust that the community has within its own police department is the gauge of the issues that happen after the officer-involved shooting.
Burrell Middleton, I'd like to go to you. What are your thoughts on the whole Black Lives Matter movement and just all the attention that's been paid? Because this certainly isn't a new issue, you know, where crime is concerned. People have interactions with police and there are unfortunate consequences. So what do you think about the fact that, you know, that's just really been amped up, in at least in the media? And is that media coverage reflective of how strongly people feel in African-American communities?
I think there are hot spots of any type of activity that goes on. As Chief Staniszewski mentioned earlier, you know, the culture of a community is extremely important. For instance, if you have people in our community here with saggy pants, drooping down and underwear showing.
Sure.
That's probably not going to go over too well because it's really not something that most of the community does around here.
Yeah, and they're not used to seeing something.
It's not. So specifically, that would be something that would be culturally, you know, an anomaly for those who may come to the community. But I think in terms of, you know, groups like Black Lives Matter, Police Lives Matter, Hispanic Lives Matter. Yeah. I mean, all lives matter. The human race matters. And I think that for the most part, I think that we have some media sensationalism to some extent. Again, we take isolated incidents and we can sensationalize those to make them whatever we want them to be. Are there some injustices that take place? Well, absolutely. In fact, to kind of give you the etymology of what happened with Juneteenth, we actually started as a racial justice group. Primarily because there were some concerns about the treatment of minorities within the community. Now, that was not something that was new. When I first came to Eau Claire in 1987, there had been concerns about gay bashing on the university's campus. There had been concerns about African-Americans being harassed in the community. There had been concerns about rapes taking place within the campus community as well as within the general Eau Claire community. So, again, you take specific situations. Those groups are going to be very sensitive to those situations. They're going to react to those situations. Are they wrong? I don't think that they're wrong. I think that those need to be kept to the degree of importance for that particular group at that particular time, and not to be broadcast and spread all over to broad brush everyone.
Chief Staniszewski.
Yeah, and I think we've made a lot of progress over those years. You talk about the 80s. It was just last year that I was invited to the Juneteenth celebration to give the keynote speech. Mm-hmm. I don't think you would have seen that 10, 15 years ago. And I think that shows the positive relationship, the connection that we've made, that there is a trust, and that here's someone that can come and speak to a group that expresses the positive interactions and what we can do. And it's really a sign of moving forward that we're working together to fix some of those injustices from the past.
Salika Duckworth-Lutton.
One of the things, too, we have to understand is that Eau Claire is not like Milwaukee and is not like New York.
How so? What do you mean?
The Eau Claire Police Department has a heavy commitment to training, has a heavy commitment to especially de-escalation training. The New York Police Department, the Baltimore Police Department, LAPD, and New Orleans, those are the leaders in police brutality cases that were considered founded, have had problems with training being resisted by older officers. Mm. Now, there's a reason why you train, and for people who have seen Malcolm Gladwell's book about tipping points, they've read one of those cases. The more training a police officer has, the less he is going to rely on unconscious bias, and the more he or she will rely on best practices. So the more training a police officer has, the less fear that police officer will have going into that situation, and then the less likely you are to see a hair trigger reaction. Mm-hmm. Because that's one of the reasons why Eau Claire, and I ran these statistics in 2010 for your predecessor, Jerry Matysik. Yeah, I know. I had to get all the names together, too. I did not grow up around Polish names. We have one of the lowest crime rates in the state of Wisconsin and mm-hmm. across the nation. We have the 8th lowest crime rate in the entire nation. People don't understand that.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Well, if you go out and run the city data yourself with SPSS, you'll figure it out. But it was also advertised, I want to say, about 8 weeks ago. As a part of the city's campaigns. Mm-hmm. So we have a police department that is a part of our community. And because they are a part of our community, they're not living in a segregated area like Simi Valley and coming in. They see us as neighbors. They don't see themselves as an occupying force. And that creates a very different dynamic between the community. But on the saggy pants, I had the hilarious experience about a week ago. I was going down the street and I just played for some dancers. So I was blasting Nutcracker in my car. And I look out to the side and there is a young white man, saggy pants, no shirt, underwear showing. And my daughter said, "Mom, he needs to put clothes on."
Oh, that's funny.
That is an Eau Claire value.
Chris Hambeck Boyle, you had something to say?
I just wanted to come full circle when I was talking about Milwaukee. For me, you know, I don't think so goes Milwaukee should go the state. So as far as statewide vouchers, I don't agree with that because Milwaukee has its own amazing story educationally. And Barbara Miner's book goes through that, gave me the perspective truly on why Milwaukee is the way it is. And I had to kind of think that through my child eyes back then. And there were parts of this book that it hit me. Like I did see that when I was little and never thought about it again till I read this book. So It was an amazing read for me to get that perspective. So your point's, you know, well taken that we are not Milwaukee. We are a pretty special place in western Wisconsin.
And Rich, I think just to do a quick reach back in terms of talking about, you know, the kids in terms of whether they understand or recognize or even know about Juneteenth. You know, it's the adult population that's extremely important at this particular time, because I think that the kids are, the children and the young people are getting that type of education. Right. There are a lot of African Americans who don't know about Juneteenth. Hmm. You know, Eau Claire was the third city in the state to begin to observe Juneteenth Day.
Behind, I would guess,
Milwaukee was first, Madison was second, then Eau Claire. Huh. And of course, in the last 2 years, Appleton and Green Bay have also come on board. So so it's the adult population, because these are the stakeholders, these are the people who are the shakers and movers, these are the people who are going to be making these changes, the immediate changes. we're now looking to the future for our children and for the young people, particularly with Juneteenth, in terms of looking at those achievements. And so that is what Juneteenth is really about at this particular time. So I just want to just put a caveat onto what we discussed earlier.
Well said. Let's take our final break here on the West Side. When we come back, we'll wrap up the discussion about Juneteenth and talk about the celebration that's going to be happening in Eau Claire. We still have some other issues to go through. We're talking about Juneteenth, and we're talking about race relations and racial relations in Eau Claire, in western Wisconsin, and, of course, abroad. 800-228-5615 is the number to call. We'd love to take your comment or question. Let us know if you would prefer. Check out the West Side Facebook page. You can comment there. We'll be back in just a bit.
Every time you tune in to Wisconsin Public Radio, you'll hear something that makes you think, feel, or understand in a new way. That's the power of WPR programs, and that's the power of your support. Our budget year ends on June 30th, and your gift right now at WPR.org really makes a difference. Thank you.
Support for WPR comes from Hooper Corporation, supplying custom construction services, including electric power, mechanical, and green technology to commercial, industrial, and utility customers nationwide. Hooper Corporation, a Wisconsin company since 1913. Support also comes from Mayo Clinic Health System, offering resources dedicated to helping families get healthy and stay healthy. Local wellness opportunities are on the classes and events page at mayoclinichealthsystem.org.
I'm Rich Kramer. You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. We're talking about Juneteenth. There's a celebration Sunday at Pavilion at the Pines Pavilion. Yeah, at Carson Park, right in the heart of the city of Eau Claire. Juneteenth is a celebration of the freeing of the last slaves in American history back in 1865. If you've got a question or a comment, let us know. 1-800-228-5615. I'm joined by Eau Claire Police Chief Jerry Stanishevsky, Burl Middleton of the Department of Corrections. He's also a Board of Directors Chairman for Uniting Bridges. Chris Hambick-Boyle is President of the Eau Claire Area School District Board of Education. And Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton is Professor of History at UW-Eau Claire. 1-800-228-5615. And I wanted to go back just a bit more and talk about the Black Lives Matter movement. And Salika, I wanted to get your thoughts on this. There was a lot of pushback to it. You know, as Burl mentioned, you've got the Police Lives Matter. You've got all these, and the question of whether the fact that people are saying only Black Lives Matter, you know, it just got into a whole kind of an ugly discussion, but they're aggressive. They were very aggressive in trying to get the word out. So what did you think about that? In Minneapolis, there were interstates that were blockaded, and they're really forcing the issue.
A number of my students are from Minneapolis, and some are members of the Black Lives Matter group. And when we hear Black Lives Matter, what we need to do is put a 2 on there. Okay. Black Lives Matter 2.
Of course.
And they are,
that should be understood, I think.
But people don't understand it, so they think it's Black Lives Matter only, but it's Black Lives Matter 2. And they're provocative. They are very provocative. But when I was going through the civil rights movement in my African American history class in these past 2 semesters, students, and I did not deliberately do it, saw parallels, especially when I was talking about the sit-ins movement, because some of the people coming on complaining about the people who did the sit-ins sounded exactly like the people complaining about Black Lives Matter.
Sure.
Black Lives Matter is aiming at disrupting commerce to force decision makers to deal with them. And that will inconvenience other people, but that forces them to have to deal with it. The majority of the middle class can ignore what happens in these hot spots because it doesn't touch them. Hmm. It's very easy to ignore it. It's very easy to say, that's not my people. I don't have to worry about it. When your interstate is disrupted, when your plane is disrupted, all of a sudden you are now disrupted in the same way. Mm-hmm. And that's what the sit-ins did. That's what the Freedom Rides did. That is what the pickets did. If you read the book, we're talking about Milwaukee. So let's go with Coleman's Long Way to Go, which is about the integration of Milwaukee and Selma of the North. Mm-hmm. That book talked about, you know, Milwaukee was actually a pioneer in the use of provocative, nonviolent tactics, because these are nonviolent tactics. I would prefer to see police engage and work with Black Lives Matter, because emerging in Texas and Western Louisiana right now is a group of neo-Black Panthers called the Huey Newton Fan Club. They are armed. Mm-hmm. They have already shown up in Dallas 2 years ago to deal with an open carry Texas situation, and they've shown up in Houston and forced those police officers to have to deal with them. If your choice is nonviolent protesters versus armed resistance, your smarter choice is nonviolent protesters. Listening to and getting past the stereotypes, because where you have a historical issue, the people with the sit-ins always dressed very conservatively, mm-hmm. carried themselves very conservatively. A lot of them were church people. Black Lives Matter activists go, why do I have to dress like I'm going to church? Why does this matter? Well, they're running into the same problem the Panthers did. People can't get past the way they dressed and the aggressiveness of their tone and their speaking. Complimentary osmosis.
People just tune out.
They just tune out. Or they will think they're violent when they're not. So because of the way they dress and because of the way they speak, they're tuned out. But if we can get past that, we can work with them. By the time you get to the Huey P. Newton Fan Club, that's no longer an option. They are going to, and they forced law enforcement to enforce the law. Open carry Texas did not carry through 5th District in Houston. My relatives are in Houston. I had to live through and listen to all of that. But I would prefer we work with the nonviolent protesters.
I want to talk now about, Jerry Staniszewski.
Yeah, you know, and the reality is, police officers, they are the guardians of democracy. So it isn't an us versus them. We are there to exist to provide that opportunity for freedom of speech, for a peaceful assembly. So visibly, we see that on the news and how they, you know, create the issues and make it look like an us versus them. But the reality is we're trying to provide that safe opportunity for people to express their feelings and opinions. So mm-hmm. that's what we really need to remember. And most communities are making that proactive step to reach out to people to say, this is how you can demonstrate peacefully. This is the way we do it. And, you know, if you want to get your message across, we can help you do that. But we don't want anybody to get hurt.
We're getting close to the top of the hour, but I wanted to ask you, do you think the media portrayed police in the right light? Do you think the media were unfair to police in these situations like the Michael Browns and, you know, like in Missouri and any of those places? Do you think that the media went a little overboard with how they characterized the situation and police?
Well, I think what is unfair is that there's a lot of assumptions made very early on. Yeah. And so there's a lot of opinions and a lot of things said without people understanding exactly what happened at that particular incident. They generalize, and then obviously when it turns negative, that's what people are attracted to. And so I think that's where the unfairness is. I welcome the critique and judgment of police officers' actions. I think there has to be some transparency and people understanding why we make the decisions we do. But waiting for the facts and to find out exactly what happened, I think, is the appropriate thing to do.
With that, I wanted to talk briefly about some of the statistics with regard to Wisconsin's prison population, and it was startling to me when I first saw this. According to a 2013 study at the University of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and this is, you know, like I said, 2013, but locks up a higher percentage of African-American men than any other state in the nation. According to 2010 census, nearly 13% of African-American men of working age were either in jail or prison right here in Wisconsin. That's nearly twice the national average. Having experience in Department of Corrections, is that surprising to you, Burl Middleton, or was it surprising to you? And do you think there any changes need to be made?
Well, again, I think that one of the issues needs to be focused on the real problem, not just the symptom.
Right.
You know, people in prison or in jail get there because they've been convicted. That's in the judicial system. Mm-hmm. It's not in the police force. It's not in the, you know, the attorneys leagues. It's within the judicial system. And I think that's where the focus should be.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
We know that some of this is a result of the disinvestment in jobs
right.
that happened in the 1980s and 90s, and you're seeing it in white rural communities today. That's why the heroin epidemic has become such a concern.
Yeah.
And what you don't want to do is to have that happen here. That's why a number of people have been worrying about the outsourcing of jobs, have been worrying about the lack of opportunities for high school diploma graduates, and have been worrying about the impact of easy availability to drugs.
Chris Hamburg.
And so I think that places a huge responsibility on public schools in our country to really work with being more inclusive and to really do the professional development with our staff that will provide courageous conversations and get us to a different place.
All right, we've got literally 1.5 minutes to go, so who's going to take it home here and tell us more about the event that's going to be happening on Sunday? Burl Middleton, go for it.
Well, again, Juneteenth Day is going to be this Sunday from 2 p.m. until approximately 3:10 p.m. There will be music thereafter, so you don't have to go home at that time. There will be free food. There will be alcohol-free environments, as well as activities for kids and other demonstrations. We want the entire community to come out because it's not a race-oriented activity. It is a celebration for achievement for all people of Eau Claire.
All right. And how many years has this been going on?
16 years here, but this dates back to 1865, and it is linked to Memorial Day celebrations, Decoration Day celebrations within Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi.
Yes. Pine Pavilion, Carson Park.
Pine Pavilion at 2 o'clock, right?
2 p.m.
All right. Thank you to all my guests. I really appreciated it. The conversation. Jerry Staniszewski is Eau Claire's police chief. Burl Middleton is with the Department of Corrections. He's also a member, chairman of the board of directors for Uniting Bridges. Chris Hambick Doyle is president of the Eau Claire Area School District Board of Education. And Dr. Salika Duxworth Lawton is a professor of history at UW-Eau Claire. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for tuning in today. Next week, we start a long slate of candidate forums for state legislative office, so stay tuned. We start with the primary for the 67th State Assembly. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for listening. Have a safe and productive week. We'll chat again next Monday.